welcome to Change Surfer Radio. For the next half hour, keep your mind open and your radio tuned to the left as we present a sexy high-tech vision of our radically democratic future. Speaking today with Dr. Richard Zweigenhaf, Richie, as he is known, is the co-author of three books on the American power structure. The first book, Jews in the Protestant Establishment, published by Prager in 1982, examined the extent to which Jews have become a part of the corporate elite, and for those who had, the ways that such elite status affected their identities as Jews. In Blacks in the White Establishment, Blacks in the White Establishment, examined the experiences of a group of black teenagers who attended elite boarding schools in the 1960s through a program called A Better Chance. And most recently, he's written with a co-author of G. William Domhoff, a very famous studier of the power structure, American power structure, Diversity in the Power Elite: Have Women and Minorities Reached the Top? And it's a look at the extent to which the power elite, which once was made up only of white Christian men, now includes Jews, African Americans, women, Latinos, Asian Americans, and gays. The book asks how much the power elite has diversified. Welcome, Dr. Zweigenhaf.
Well, thanks for having me.
My pleasure. And I want to know, you say that the tradition is inspired by C. Wright Mills. How was C. Wright Mills's concept of the power elite different from the traditional Marxist understanding of ruling class?
Well, let me first also mention that all three of the books you noted in my introduction were co-authored with Bill Domhoff. This is a trilogy that the three of us have done. I mean, the two of us have done. We think of it as our trilogy. So he's the co-author on all three, not just this most recent book. C. Wright Mills was a sociologist at Columbia, and in 1956 he published The Power Elite, which was an academic book. It was published by Oxford University Press, but it generated widespread interest, became a term that I think many Americans are now familiar with. Mills saw three institutions as having emerged as the basis for power in America in those post-war years, and they were the corporate elite, the political elite, and the military elite, and he looked extensively and in detail at the people who sat at the highest positions in those three seats of institutional power. At the time he was writing, it was a lily-white male group of people, as was indicated in your introduction. It was almost all men, almost all Christians. And as you've indicated, we seek in this current book to take a more contemporary look at the power elite. And I'll come back and say a little bit more about what we found. In terms of your question about the ruling class or a Marxist analysis, Mills rejects the term ruling class in one passage in The Power Elite. He points out that class is really an economic term, and ruling is really a power term, and whereas Marxists tend to assume that class is the sole relevant variable to understanding power, Mills saw it as more complex. He certainly acknowledged that economic power is quite important in America, was in 56 and continues to be, but was not willing to reduce or not prone to reduce his analysis to solely to economic terms. And by the time we do our look in the 1990s, we're looking at gender issues and race issues and political issues.
But for Mills, it meant including people like military leaders and famous entertainers and other people who had roles in the power structure.
Well, yes and no. That is, for each of the three institutions of power, he very carefully operationally defines who he means. So, for the military, he means the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the people at the very top of the military hierarchy. Mm-hmm. For the corporate elite, he means the chief executive officers and the people on the boards of directors of the largest companies in America. He tended to look at the top 100 or 200 subsequent power structure researchers, and we look at the Fortune 500 or the Fortune 1000. For the political elite, he looked at the executive branch. It was his view that the real political power had fallen into the executive branch, and he looked, therefore, at presidents, vice presidents, and cabinets. He does have a chapter on celebrities, and he's interested in rich people who don't hold those seats of power, but his his argument is that the real power fell in the power elite, and celebrities were in part a distraction, and rich people might try to influence the decisions of people in power. But he would not have seen, for instance, Frank Sinatra as a part of the power elite. Or let's say Humphrey Bogart. I have to get my years right for a 56 comment here. I guess Sinatra was around. It wouldn't have seen celebrities as part of the power elite, but as working with the power elite in terms of maintaining the economic structure.
So what were some of the databases that you used to do this study?
Well, what we did, first of all, let me just say that by the mid-90s, it was clear to me and to Bill Domhoff that the power elite had diversified. What was once, as I've said, pretty much a lily-white group of men included people like Colin Powell. He had been the chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, included Janet Reno sitting on a presidential cabinet. There included the chief executive officer at Coca-Cola, a man named Roberto Goizueta, who was a Cuban immigrant. So there seemed to be diversity, and if you used as your data the faces that moved across the television screen on the nightly news, you might think, gee, there's a lot of diversity. We wanted to look more systematically, and so our data included the kinds of operational definitions that Mills used, that is, who's sitting in those seats of power. And we looked at to see if there are Jews, women, blacks, Latinos, Asian Americans, and gay men and lesbians in those seats. What that means is, if you think of a table with three columns across the top, political, military, and corporate, and six columns going down, or rows down the left, Jews, women, blacks, Asian Americans, Latinos, etc., there are 18 different cells in this table, and we use slightly different methods to try to get the answers to address the question, well, are there, for instance, Asian Americans in the corporate elite? So we used a variety of methods, but those were the kind of data we were looking for.
And your basic conclusion is that there is diversity, increasing diversity in the power elite, but that the core, you say here, the core of the power elite is still rich, white, Christian males.
Yes. Certainly, compared to 1956, there's a lot more diversity than there used to be. And the diversity has increased over time, more so for some groups than others. That is, for example, when we looked at Jews, a group we had looked at in the early 80s for our first book together, from the early 80s to the mid-90s or late 90s, Jews are not only in the power elite, but they're overrepresented. If you look at number of Jewish senators, number of Jews on corporate boards, they're there. The discrimination that once existed in terms of Jews and power,
they've long since become white people.
That's right. That's right. If you look at women, you find that there are a lot more women now than there used to be, but they're still tremendously underrepresented when you accept the fact that half the population, slightly more than half the population, are women. There are a handful of women who are chief executive officers of the Fortune 1000, but only a handful. 996 or 997, depending on what day you're talking, are men. And most of those men are white, and most of those men are Christian. So the answer is yes, there's more diversity, but the power elite in the corporate, military, or political realm remains mainly white men, mainly Christian men.
And you also found that most of the folks, the Asian Americans or the African Americans who get into power elite positions, they didn't come from Harlem or they didn't come off the Vietnamese boat people exodus. They were folks who had privilege in their previous family backgrounds, and that it takes a couple generations to go from being in the bottom of the social ladder to get to the top.
That's right. And this was fascinating. And as Mills and others had pointed out that successful American businessmen for generations have put forth the argument that they pulled themselves up by their own bootstraps. But when Mills and others looked at their backgrounds, they found that by and large, most came from the upper classes, upper class, upper middle class, about two-thirds came from relative privilege. They tend to confirm the one of my favorite songs by Steve Forbert, Takes a Whole Lot of Help to Make It on Your Own. When we started looking at various immigrants who had made it, like Roberto Goizueta, who I mentioned a few minutes ago, a pattern emerged, and it was, and the pattern was that they may have come as relatively poor immigrants compared to previous circumstances, but they many tended to come from the upper classes of their country. Goizueta, for example, there's a lot of attention given to the fact that he came to America with only $20 in his pocket and had to leave at the time of the revolution in Cuba in 59 or 60. And this is true. He came relatively penniless. But what we found is that his mother was one of the wealthiest sugar heiresses in the country. His father was a successful architect, businessman. He had gone to prep school in your state, Connecticut. He had gone to Yale. He had stock in Coca-Cola. So when he left Cuba to come work for Coca-Cola in America instead of in Havana, he had all kinds of social capital and economic capital in the form of stock. So Goizueta, this is not true of every immigrant we studied, but we did see that pattern emerge. There were places where we do see rags-to-riches stories, but not nearly as many as the mythology argues. The area of the power elite where you're most likely to see it is in elected office, in Congress, and especially the House of Representatives rather than the Senate, where if you look at African Americans, for example, a higher percentage of the men and women in those roles have come from real poverty, but it's still not the majority. It's still the majority are from privileged backgrounds or at least middle class backgrounds.
Now, you also talk in your book about, by the way, I'm speaking with Dr. Richard Zweigenhaft. He's a collaborator with G. William Domhoff on a series of studies of ethnic, gender, diversity in the ruling class, and most recently in diversity in the power elite. Ruling class, not power elite. Power elite's the key concept here. You also talk about how these different ethnic and gender minorities who have risen into power elite positions have assimilated the values of the power elite, that in order to fit in to the old boys network that still is at the core here, they have, or perhaps just because of their structural position in society, they have changed their politics. They no longer are in sync with the interests of the populations which they allegedly represent.
Yeah, I don't know if I'd say that that's true across the board, but what is true across the board is that in order to make it into these circles, you have to be perceived as someone who won't rock the boat too much. Now, there are certain times when, let's say, corporations have needed minority members on their boards to demonstrate to the community that they are seeking to diversify, that they are trying to reach out. But what's fascinating is that, first of all, the people that are selected often are people who can play the game and have indicated that they're willing to play the game. This has been true for, as we look at some of the women who make it into the higher circles, and then we look at some of the men in these ethnic groups. But the other thing that happens is that over time you become part of the club. Think, for example, of why Jesse Jackson isn't on corporate boards and Vernon Jordan is. They both started out as activists. My guess is Jesse Jackson might not want to be on corporate boards. It might dilute the influence he has in his constituency.
He didn't pick up golf.
That's right. But Vernon Jordan's an interesting case. He was the head of the National Urban League. He first went on boards to provide a voice for African Americans, and I think he still provides a voice for African Americans, but I think there's no doubt that Vernon Jordan has become an insider. He's a presidential friend. He sits on we like
a little bit more than a friend, I would say.
right.
Procurer sometimes.
Right. We like Mills. look carefully at interlocking directors, that is, men and women who sit on multiple corporate boards. One of the studies that we did in the chapter on African Americans looked at all of the African Americans who sat on at least three boards, Fortune-level boards in 1994. And Vernon Jordan, by far, was the leader. He was on 9 or 10 boards. He earned, at that point, hundreds of thousands of dollars per year as a corporate director. He perhaps calls for some liberal change, but he's not rocking the boat the way I think others might.
So, in that sense, these and the term token, of course, you avoid it. I think pretty conspicuously in your book, to your credit. But I mean, many people would talk about this in terms of tokenism, that bringing in representatives of these groups into power elite positions provides political legitimacy. It covers the left flank of these different institutions, so they can say, "Hey, look, we've got African Americans in our cabinet. We've got an African American on the Supreme Court. He may be a fascist or a right winger or whatever,
right. But."
You know, we're covered in that. And so it actually functions to reinforce ruling class rule or power elite rule instead of undermine it in any way.
Well, I think that argument can be made, and I think that some corporations have very much chosen people with that in mind. There are now enough watchdog groups and individuals who go on these boards who I think indicate to the boards, I don't want to be the only one. I'm willing to go on this board if there's some genuine commitment to diversify. Now, sometimes that happens, sometimes it doesn't. In the case of women, for example, there's a group in New York called Catalyst that's been monitoring the presence of women on corporate boards, and they're very good. They not only publish these annual reports and quarterly reports indicating how women are doing in the corporate world, but they identify those companies that have more than one woman on the board, those that have more than two on their boards, and so there's the tendency toward tokenism. There are also people who are lobbying for it to be more than that.
Mm-hmm. And you also talk about the fact not all the groups you study have been equally successful in contributing to the new diversity in the power elite. Women, blacks, Latinos, Asian Americans, and openly homosexual men and women are all underrepresented, but to varying degrees. So which groups are having it harder? Is it harder for homosexuals to get into power elite positions?
Absolutely. But I have to say here, methodologically, we face dilemmas on how to get numbers with, say, you know, Asian Americans or Jews, but with homosexual men and lesbians, it was even harder. And therefore,
with women, you can go with their first name generally.
Well, with women, you can go with their first name, or if you can see pictures of the corporate board members, which now with the website, you often can just look them up and see what they look like, and that can help you with. With most African Americans, with some Latinos, there are various groups that are monitoring how many Hispanics are on boards, how many blacks are on boards.
Uh-huh. But the SEC doesn't do a report on how many gays have been on corporate boards.
That's right. And we weren't really interested in outing anybody. What we wanted to know is whether you could be on a corporate board and be openly homosexual. So
right.
Our method, our operational definition became this. Are there men or women who are openly homosexual who are in the power elite? And the answer was almost exclusively no. Though while we were doing the research for our book and kind of finishing up the manuscript for the chapter on gays, gay men and lesbians, a retired member of the board at Ford Motor Company came out in an interview with a magazine, and he made it clear he would not have done so while he was still working on a daily basis for Ford, but having retired, he was willing to, and he made it clear that the stigma is still pretty great in the corporate world for that kind of openness. At the same time, I would again stress that if you're gay and in the corporate world, things are much better now than they were. It's C. Wright Mills time, and they're better than they were 20 years ago or 10 years ago. There is an increasing acceptance of the presence and their benefits for partners for homosexual men and lesbians. But at the highest level where we're looking, at the corporate elite, and on cabinets, for instance.
Well, for Christ's sake, Malcolm Forbes was gay, you know. So, you know, if the leader of the Capitalist Tool magazine can be gay, it's not...
Wait, is he openly gay?
Well, I don't know. I read it in all the tabloids. I don't know what to tell you.
Right.
Now, you also talk about the fact that that a lot of this inclusion came about from the result of minority and feminist pressure.
Right.
But yet it has the consequence of reinforcing power elite rule in certain ways. So I want to ask you this very sensitive question about affirmative action. What do you think the upshot is of this kind of a study in terms of affirmative action? Now, you're only focusing on the very top echelons of our society,
right.
So affirmative action in a very narrow sense. But in a sense, it raises questions about our whole society. Affirmative action for higher education would fall prey to the same criticism that kids who can pass the muster to get into elite institutions, elite law schools or whatever, even with an affirmative action bump up, are generally not going to be kids who didn't already have advantages in their background for one reason or another. So a lot of the criticisms that you make of affirmative action at the top of our society could be made about affirmative action at lower levels as well. Do you see those ramifications? Do you think that affirmative action is in some ways a distraction from the overall goal of minimizing social inequality in our society?
Well, let me put it this way. I think there's been real progress in the right direction in terms of diversifying the power elite and in the larger society. I think the data indicate, for instance, with African Americans, that the black middle class is much bigger than it used to be. There are a lot more blacks who have been able to make it into the higher circles of management, and we too find an increased presence of blacks in the power elite. It's not what we would like. I think it's quite clear that these numbers would not be as high as they are without having had affirmative action. I think it's these policies have put government pressure on corporations and on educational institutions. I don't think we're there yet to a point where we can say we don't need it anymore, and I do think that without it, things are likely to get much worse again rather quickly.
Mm-hmm. But you don't see this as the policy that does it for social equality?
I don't.
Yeah.
I don't.
Yeah, so you would agree with socialist critics or critics who want to have class-based affirmative action, for instance, as another adjunct to this, or just have a more democratic society so that these institutions wouldn't be so dominating in our lives?
I'd advocate both, but I mean, I do think a class-based component makes sense. But see, the other thing we haven't talked about today, but is a very, I think, an important part of our findings in the book, is that the issue of race continues to be a powerful one in this society. It's not just class, as Marxists might argue. We do one study where we look at the skin color of the African Americans who have made it into the power elite, and we compare them with another group of prominent African Americans. And we use this technique that's been developed by some psychologists who are concerned about self-esteem and psychological issues, and we find that the African Americans who have made it into the highest circles are lighter skinned. This is true for Asian American. For Latinos as well. So I think the power, as important as class is in this culture, so too does race remain very important. And I think affirmative action is an acknowledgement of that.
And do you think that holds true for women as well? I mean, they're very different kinds of discrimination against women and people of color in this society. And women are in some ways much more intimate with ruling class structures. I mean, after all, every white Christian man has usually
right.
been married to a white Christian woman. And many of the women who first filled positions in Congress were the widows of
right.
usually conservative white men who died, and then they took over their shoes and off in their politics. So do you think that gender plays the same role, that we need affirmative action for women as well?
I would say less so than for race, in my view. One of the findings in our chapter on women is that a good percentage of those who have made it into the higher circles in the corporate world are from privileged backgrounds. And you're right. I mean, all these men, or most of these men, were married. Many of them had daughters. And many of the women who are making it into the into these higher circles in the corporate world started out with real privilege. So I don't think the argument holds as well for women.
Mm-hmm. Well, I've been speaking with Dr. Richard Zweigenhaft. He's a professor at Guilford College and a collaborator with G. William Domhoff on a series of books about diversity in the power elite, most recently publishing Diversity in the Power Elite from Yale University Press. And I really thank you for coming with us today.
Well, thanks a lot. It's been fun for me.
You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio. Change Surfer Radio is produced at WHUS-FM at the University of Connecticut in Storrs. If you want to learn more about radical democratic transhumanism, or you want to share your thoughts about this show with me, Dr. J, email me at jhughes, J-H-U-G-H-E-S, at changesurfer.com. Also, check out past and future shows and myriad relevant links at the website, www.changesurfer.com.